Good afternoon, my time. Good morning. Oops. And some of you, I know it's the middle of the night.
A little trouble here.
So I want to start by reading something that I just came across, which is from a really interesting little book called A Rumor of Angels, The Modern Society and the Rediscovery of the Supernatural. And he's talking about play and about how in play, the serious world where, you know, terrible things go on and we're subject to time and death, these things are suspended when, you know, when we're playing, which, and I associate this with meditation, actually. I think that when we're in meditation, when we're doing spiritual practice, we can enter the world of play. And if we can do that, and if we can take ourselves away from taking it as seriously as we take our work, you know, and all the other, our children, you know, our financial situation, all the things that cause so much intensity through their seriousness, then we actually can, this is what this writer says, we actually enter the realm of the eternal through play. So this is a quote from C.S. Lewis, the great author of the Narnia books, who is also, as you many of you know, a spiritual philosopher, a Catholic philosopher, actually, maybe he was Church of England. He was a don at Oxford and also a pastor. So in a sermon at the beginning of World War II, he said, human life has always been lived on the edge of a precipice. Men propound mathematical theorems in beleaguered cities, conduct metaphysical arguments in condemned cells, make jokes on scaffolds, discuss the last new poem while advancing to the walls of Quebec, and comb their hair at Thermopylae. This is not panache, it is our nature. You know, isn't that so gorgeous? You know, I mean, the thing is that everything we do that takes us out of the ordinary and reveals the, you know, the vast eternal world that, you know, that philosophy and meditation and art and play itself, playing hopscotch, can reveal, is what allows human beings to regain and ecstatically realize the deathless joy of childhood. This is C.S. Lewis's point. And I want to say, because right at the beginning, before we get into the questions, I got an email today privately from someone who didn't want to put this on the listserv, but it really spoke to me, and I'm going to talk about it here because I think it'll be helpful to some of you as well. And what this person said is that they're liking the class, they're following the philosophical, theological, theoretical parts, but their meditation is not vibrant right now. So the subtle meditations don't work for them. And they're feeling, you know, there's something wrong with them because that's not happening. And what I wanted to say here, just as we begin, just in case anyone else is having that feeling and is embarrassed to say it in public, is that because the gunas are constantly chasing each other through our inner world, there are going to be times when meditation feels dull and it's very hard to get to the subtle aspects of our being. And there are other times when, you know, the inner world feels really open, vibrant, exciting, sometimes too exciting. So one of the things that I've learned over the years, because my meditation goes through these ups and downs just like everybody else's, is that if worst comes to worst and you just cannot deal with anything subtler than just managing to sit down for 20 minutes, my suggestion is that you just begin your meditation by noticing the breath coming in and out of the nostrils in very, very basic, in that very basic way it's taught in, you know, fundamental mindfulness practice or samatha meditation or yoga meditation. And if you're just present to the flow of the breath, you're at, you know, and most of you know this, so it's not like I'm giving you deep esoteric knowledge, but your mind will start to come to rest. The scattered qualities of it will begin to dissolve, and you'll actually find yourself going into that liminal state that eventually can lead you into a genuine subtle awareness. So that's enough to subtleize your consciousness. And so if the more complex or more targeted or more subtle meditations seem like they're too much for you right now, no worries. Just go to the breath in the nostrils and notice that at a certain point, your attention will become subtler. And then you very well might be able to follow it up to the soft palate, to the top of the Ajna, and to begin to feel that space in the Ajna and even stretch it down to the heart. So let's just start with that this morning. So please find a posture and close your eyes. Notice the flow of the breath, the sensations in your body. And just allow yourself to zero in attentionally on the connection between the breath and the edge of your nostrils. And just for a second, ask yourself, what is aware of the breath? So I always start my meditation that way, no matter what my intention is for other, you know, let's say deeper, subtler, more playful or experimental practices. I always start just noticing the breath in the nostrils, partly, of course, because that is, as any good Buddhist teacher will tell you, that's the way we come into the present moment, because the breath is always in the present moment. And the whole essence of getting yourself into a receptive state for meditation, of course, is giving yourself the opportunity to come into the present moment. And from there, anything can happen. So who has questions?
I'll just tell you, if you want to raise your hand, you can, you'll either find it under the reactions in the bottom menu bar, or if you hit participants, it might show up down there, and that will help. If we can't, because we have somebody on the call, we can't see everybody if they're raising their hands. So Bari has raised her hand. So if you want to unmute yourself.
Hi, Bari.
Hi, Sally. I've asked this question before, so I'm clearly coming to it with hopes of getting a different answer. And I may not. As I begin meditation, I have very big coughing fits, sometimes rather violent. And it's just intense. And it's been going on for years. Any advice towards how to deal with it would be gratefully. I mean, the last time I asked, you had said that it was probably my bronchioles were upset by the energy into it, coming into it. But
how long does it last? Does it last the whole time, or does it come to an end at a certain point?
It does come to an end. It does.
As someone who coughs a lot, I have various interpretations of what it means to cough during meditation. And I really don't have an answer that I would call a general answer, but I actually think that some of it probably has to do with the air quality around your puja. Are you using candles? Are you using, sandalwood powder? Do you have flowers that you might be allergic to? In other words, see if you can clear the area so that there's not really anything that could be causing the cough. And unfortunately, what I discovered is that I can't burn candles on my puja. So,
I'm not burning candles. Yeah, burning candles. And it could happen outside where, in the summer where it's just, I don't have flowers.
Well, it's probably, assuming you don't have a cold or a bronchial condition, it's probably allergies and, but here's the thing, if this is happening, then you just have to cough it out. Eventually it'll come back. You'll just come back to, the coughing will be gone and you'll be silent. Sometimes it's just conditions in our life that we have to move past. And, and it helps if you don't worry about it, if you just kind of take the position, all right, this is how my constitution
acts. And it's clearly around my heart, because it's when I'm moving energy, the moment that I get anywhere near my heart, it's just explosive in that way. So.
Right. So there's something in your cardiovascular system that's probably activated. Perhaps by deliberate conscious breathing, but you could probably figure it out if you start asking the question. So, why is this happening, and is there anything I can do about it? And in the meantime, just let it be and let it resolve.
Okay.
And don't spend a lot of energy trying to make it go away.
Okay. That's advice. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for everything. And the other question I have is, what's next?
Okay, we'll talk about that. Thank you, Bari.
Thank you.
So the next person we have is someone with a 707 area code. I just asked you to unmute.
Hi, it's Annabelle here.
Hi, Annabelle.
Hi. I just want to ask a quick question that you've kind of already I think you may have already answered it, but I'm still confused about the direction of the breathing. You know, from the first class where we exhaled up above the crown of the head and then inhaled down, and then this one where it's the opposite. And what you said is that there's different schools that have different ways of breathing. So does it matter? Should I just choose the one I like?
I would suggest you choose the one you like.
Okay.
Yes, I know it's confusing. And normally I teach the breath inhaling down and exhaling up. The reason that I've been doing it this way in this class is because the so-called official instructions for the meditation on the soft palate and the ajna involve following the pathway of the breath from the nostrils up to the soft palate and then up to the ajna. So it just, you know, it's easier to find your way in that meditation if you're inhaling up. But what I find often happens, and maybe just to me, because I'm so used to inhaling down, exhaling up, is that at a certain point when you settle into that practice, and when I say settle in, I mean when your attention has, you know, kind of settled into the ajna, and you're beginning to feel a kind of rising and falling of the subtle currents of pranashakti in the inner body. The breath for me reverts to inhale up, exhale down. I mean, sorry, inhale down, exhale up. Confusing even myself. So in other words, we begin a practice following instructions, and at some point your practice is going to morph because your inner body, your shakti is going to go into dhyana. You know, from dharana, it's going to go into dhyana, and the actual meditation experience will often change, and the breathing will often change. So my experience and my advice is, when that starts to happen, let it be what it is, and don't try to correct it. You know, just
can I ask one more sort of offshoot
sure.
of this?
Sure.
So I've really enjoyed the practice that we did from the last class of inhaling down into the perineum and then up to above the crown. So that kind of bypasses the nostrils and the
yes.
soft palate and all of that. So I'm assuming that these two different techniques, just they just bring you to two different states. Does it matter which one of those two I use?
No. You know, so each of them will, each of them cooks, so to speak. Each of them, as you get more deeply into it, takes you deeper. And generally speaking, in your own meditation, and I hope I've said this earlier in the class, and it's really good to have your daily meditation be one particular practice. So in this class, we're doing the ajna to heart practice as our daily practice. Because when you're doing the same practice every day, it your psyche actually tunes into it, and it becomes easier to go deeper with that practice. So that said, if you feel more comfortable with the vertical practice, and I'm sure many of you do, because we in general in our, you know, in many of our classes, especially the classes on tantric texts, we tend to work with Sushumna breathing, with this vertical practice, inhale down, exhale up. So if that's where you feel most comfortable and most awake, by all means do it in your daily meditation.
Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you. Because I kept thinking, like, which should I do, and changing around, and it's kind of, you know,
yeah. So
that's great. That's good to know.
That's exactly what you shouldn't do. And I realize I'm partly responsible for that because I'm giving people meditation practices. But I do want to encourage you to experiment, but in your daily sit, do one thing. I mean, unless you get a message from the goddess, unless your meditation just changes in midstream, then of course go with that. But don't try to experiment in your daily session. I really suggest, Let me just consider that statement. My suggestion, and this is how I've always done my practice, is that I have one meditation session. I meditate twice a day. And in the first meditation session, I'm just, my intention is to enter into meditation as deeply as possible. In the second meditation session, usually because it's later in the day, my mind is often more active. That's when I do the experimental practices. So, that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to just say, okay, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm going to play. On Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or whatever your schedule is, I'm going to do the main practice that I'm working with.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much. That's just what I needed to hear.
Well, thank you for asking the question, Annabelle.
Thank you for this unbelievably inspiring class, as always.
Well, thank you for being who you are, and that goes for all of you. We couldn't do it without each other.
We have Gail.
Hi, Gail.
Hi, Sally. I'm so enjoying this. It is so rich and so good. And I'm so grateful. I was wondering when you guided us through coming up in above the crown, and then at the end, I think you said, and now always before you finish your meditation, bring it back down into your heart.
Yeah.
And I was kind of playing with that and feeling I could stay up here and ground into my feet and come back. I'm pretty sure once I get up and walk around, I would be someplace else. But I was just wondering what the thought behind that is.
It's basically for grounding.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's because, first of all, for most people, when you're when your attention is really up here in Sahasrara, up in the upper Dwadishanta, you're kind of out of the body.
Okay.
Or actually fully out of the body in some cases. So, and that's not really a very healthy way to enter the world. So that's the reason. And whereas when you're meditating in the heart, you are actually, the heart obviously is inside the body. And it's also a very relational space. You can relate to other people much more easily and empathically. That whereas the upper Sahasrara is very much not in the physical world, even though we may still have a part of our intention in the body, in truth, our consciousness is beyond the body. It's a transcendent place. So you just want to, it's very important when you're doing your life to be embodied.
Yeah. I think some of it, maybe I'm just not going that far out of my body. But it totally, to me, feels really juicy to be up here.
Oh, yeah.
And it feels good to be in my heart, but not as good. I need to spend more time in my heart. I don't know.
Well, are you talking about being in the Sahasrara like 24/7?
No. Just if I'm meditating and I'm in that energy, that just tends to be where I go in meditation, and it feels expansive. It feels spaciousness. And in my heart, it does just have more.
It's more in the body. It's more embodied.
Yeah, it's more in the body. Okay. Yeah.
So great. There's, meditate in the Sahasrara. It is the, the highest chakra, or the bottom of complete expansion. It's great to meditate there. That what I would say, just from my experience with myself and other people, is that if you're going to focus on a spiritual center during the course of daily life, the heart or the hara, the navel center, are just better for your health. If for no other reason, it's better for your relationships. If you're spending too much time above the body, out of the body, transcendently, out of the body, it kind of leaves the physical body, you know, sort of empty of consciousness. Not that anything is ever empty of consciousness, but, you know, it's, this is how people who meditate a lot get health problems, get really skinny, you know, get malnourished. It's because they're walking around up here. And that is considered a very high yogic practice. In fact, the Vijnanabhairava, there's a sutra in the Vijnanabhairava just towards the end, which says, if you can remain in the upper Dvadashanta 24/7, you will be liberated very soon. I'm sure that's true. But I would say that way of living your life is for people who don't have families, who don't have work, who aren't trying to interface with the world, and who don't really care about the state of their body. So yes, in meditation and
even honestly, I just go there and in meditation, and I come, I'm sure I'm in my body throughout the day.
There you are too, Gail. You
are. But I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Maria, has a question?
Maria, you can
unmute yourself.
I'm sorry. Thank you for doing the question and answer sessions and for this course. It's been wonderful and you know, on so many levels, and the questions keep coming. One question I had was the Bhagavad Gita. If you could just tell me the interpretation, or the, sorry, I don't know if that's the right word, which
translation?
Yes, thank you.
Well, boy, there's so many translations of the Bhagavad Gita, and you know, every great philosopher in the Indic tradition was compelled to write a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. So you're going to get different perspectives on it depending on which translation you read. There is one that was written by Brittany Balliet, which if you'll just hold on a second, I
sure have
a bookstore, my bookcase.
Sorry, yes.
All right, guys.
This is an academic. Can everyone see this?
Yeah.
This is an academic translation by a really wonderful scholar named J.B. Van Buitenen. It's part of his translation of the Mahabharata, and it's, you know, it has the Sanskrit. There's this one by Georg Feuerstein. Georg Feuerstein. George without an E. He's pronounces it Georg. Feuerstein. This is a good one.
Uh-huh.
This is the one I was talking about by Winthrop Sargent. And this is it's just the text with the Sanskrit and a transliteration. And then there's this one by
Sally. That one, is that Whitney?
I misnamed this guy and Whitney Balliet both were old New Yorker writers, so I mixed them up. Winthrop Sargent is the
His name?
Winthrop Sargent.
Winston?
Winthrop.
Winthrop. Sargent.
Yeah. And
Sargent? Okay.
Okay. So anyway, there's many, many more. And,
okay.
And, you know, Swami Satchidananda has done one. Yogananda Paramahamsa has done one. There's one by Abhinavagupta. One by Shankaracharya. There's many, many such, there's many commentaries. Nobody, as far as I know, has done a commentary, the Bhagavad Gita, in which they collect all the commentaries.
Right.
But, so if you want to study it, I suggest you get a few of the translations and compare them.
Yeah, no, I had one. I think it was the Swami Satchananda, and I've had to get whatever. It's, you know, I don't have it anymore. So I was just wondering. I think that's the one I did have. Just a couple other really quick questions. I had an interesting experience where I did I really focused on the exercise of being in my heart for the whole day. It's easier than I thought it would be. And I keep trying to like just stay there and really just, you know, consciously bring my attention there. And then that night I had a really interesting dream about, and I know you mentioned dreams recently too, about, I can't remember, you said there's certain.
We experience the tanmatras and the inner senses in dreams. So they're, and yeah, they're dreams that are very, very, let's call them spiritual or prophetic.
So the dream was that I had this, I was like, it was this kitten, and there was like this incredible connection with this. I mean, I'm a cat person, but I just have a connection with this kitten, and it was just, the kitten was so happy, and it was just like we were playing, and there was this, like, both, you know how kittens are very contained and very vulnerable at the same time, and but just like this wonderful connection. It just made me very happy, and I thought about that dream, and I was like, was that my heart? Like, was that like, you know, like what, like, because it was a dream that really, you know, stayed with me, and it was after this whole experience, and I woke up remembering it, which I don't always remember my dreams.
Well, in a past life as a cat, no. there's a sutra in book four, which talks about past lives. This is a little bit of a joke, but
yeah,
which talks about past life samskaras, and they use the analogy of a cat. Oh. So if you were a cat 100 lifetimes ago, or 3 lifetimes ago, you're still going to have some cat samskaras in your karmic backpack, which I think is really quite interesting. So even though your samskaras are mostly human samskaras, there's animal samskaras that we all have, because we've all been animals, at least, you know, according to the Indian and the Hindu and Buddhist views of reincarnation. So a lot of the experiences that we have of animals and meditation, or our connections to animals, very well could be kind of tribal, in the sense that you were that animal, you know what it feels like to be that animal. So that's, you know, that's a possible explanation. But here's the most important thing. When you have a dream and you see an image that feels significant to you, there's a way of actually getting that image to speak to you. And you know, you go back into the dream, or you imagine yourself back into the dream, and you imagine yourself entering through the ear. And I believe the instruction is the left ear. And so that you kind of go into the dream figure with the sense of wanting to inhabit it, asking the question, okay, what are you telling me? How do you feel? Who are you? All those questions you might ask. You know, what do you have to do with me? And you can have some very powerful recognitions about dream characters by doing that. So I suggest you do that with the cat.
Do you do that in your meditation?
Well, you can do it in meditation, or I generally do it, you know, when I wake up from the dream, if you're willing to wake up. It's good to do it fairly soon after the dream.
Okay.
But if you're really doing serious dream work, you know, you would wake up from a dream, you'd write it down.
Yes.
People are doing serious dream work, keep a little flashlight, and then they write it before they forget it, even without fully waking up. But, and then in the morning, or before meditation, or after meditation, or any time, you know, just do that practice and keep your journal there and write down what comes up.
Okay. It's
often very revelatory.
And I know I don't want to take up a lot of time, but just one other really quick question. You know, you mentioned that the prayer of sort of your prayer practice of when you're in a deep meditation, sort of asking for guidance about a very, you know, important matter or something where you want assistance. And I'm just curious if, because I mean, there's different theories on this, you know, like there's the quantum physics sort of headspace where you can do this with, you know, the universe and put it out into the universe and, you know, and you should be very positive about it. And then there's other times when I feel like, well, no, I have this, you know, a deeper connection going on internally. And I sort of want to ask Shakti for, you know, the support and help. And that's sort of, there is a conflict about, you know, different ways of going about this. So I was just curious, you know, your views on that.
Which is correct. Well, first of all, this universe has infinite layers to it.
Right.
And these layers, in a certain sense, are accessible at different levels of consciousness. So there will be levels of consciousness at which it feels like the best way to pray or to ask for something is by just putting it into the universe. And there are times when you want to actually target, be very specific in the targeting. And this is kind of the art of prayer, is just being willing to, kind of, like everything else, experiment with it.
Right.
So find your own prayer practice.
Okay.
Partly because I'm very engaged in, you know, my devotional practice is very much with Goddess right now. Though for many years, when I prayed, I would pray to my guru's guru, Nityananda. And these days I pray to the Goddess. But what I normally do is ask these questions or make these prayers on the way into meditation, not necessarily when I'm deeply in meditation, because when you're deeply in meditation, you don't necessarily want a lot of extra words or desires coming into your mind. But if you ask it before meditation, then it kind of kindles the prajna. So as you go, insight might come, or the insight might arise after meditation.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. You're welcome. Question. All right.
Sadhana. She's not on video, but she's...
Hi, Sally. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. So I have a couple of quick things. So she's talking about the cat. I have a cardinal who visits me every morning. It is like, it's so like heartwarming. Like as soon as I get to the window in the morning, like he's there, he perches on the thing. There's a bird feeder. He hardly ever eats on the bird feeder. He keeps staying there, staring, looking around, goes away, comes back. But the days I'm not there, I have asked other family members, they say he doesn't come. And today I was sitting all day by it because we had a lot of snow. So he was there the whole time. Is there any significance to that?
Well, it's not that unusual.
Mm.
You know, and I think many people have the experience of certain birds, usually birds. There's a book called Backyard Birds, in which I haven't read, I've just heard about it. But apparently one of the things it purports to do is translate the language of birds. You know, that apparently it's possible now for people who aren't necessarily major intuitives to understand bird language, because, you know, bird calls have, you know, they're patterned. So one of the things that this book says is that what birds in your backyard are mostly talking about is you. So in other words, they're saying, oh, here she is. Oh, she went inside. You know, what is she doing with the bird feeder? They're very, very conscious of us. So this bird just probably likes you.
Oh, but there's no other spiritual significance to that.
People say
cardinal have some.
There may well be. I mean, you could look. I'm not aware of particular significance for a cardinal, but you know, there's quite a few books on the meaning of animals. you know, when animals come into your, there's, I'm trying to remember the name of it. One of you probably remembers it. If you do, put it in the chat box. It's a very famous book about animal symbolism, claiming to be connected to the Native American tradition. And there, I don't remember the cardinal being in that book, but you could probably get some information about what people have discovered about the meaning of particular birds.
Okay. Now, the second thing was that when we were doing the heart chakra meditation, I think it was the second session. So during the meditation, I had like this experience, like everything was like pumping. My heart was pumping hard. Then my ears, I could hear the heart pumping. I could feel the blood like in the ears, and then the fingers and everywhere. It lasted for a while, you know, and then eventually it subsided. So I was not sure why was that happening, like so much like a heart pumping that you feel it, and then you can even feel the in the ears and feel it everywhere in the body.
Yeah, it's one of the effects of focusing in the heart center is that you can at times begin to feel your heartbeat very, very strongly. Sometimes people get, you know, nervous about it because it can feel as though, you know, you wonder if there's something wrong with your heart. It's actually the result of bringing attention to that center. So, and it's fine. It's not.
But you feel it in the ears and like a fingers and everywhere, like, you know?
Yeah.
The pumping.
Because it is everywhere. That's what the heart does. And when you get really sensitive to the heartbeat, you can put your hand on your leg and you can feel it there. There's a meditation that I sometimes teach of finding the pulsation in a different part of your body and meditating on pulsation, which is a way of meditating in the heartbeat. It's a very beautiful way to meditate. So that's great. And I noticed, I just looked in the chat box, there's a lot of information about on the chat box, including from a couple of people. Red cardinal represents Kundalini rising, Katie said. And someone else says it's often Sally Stone says, some people sense their loved one who's passed coming to them in the form of a cardinal. So
there you go. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. And then the last thing is that when we are meditating in Sahasra, I feel a lot of tingling. Is that all part of the chakra opening?
It's very, very normal reaction. It's the physical experience of Shakti in the Sahasra. So it's great.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the questions.
All right. Sally Stone, if you want to unmute yourself.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi, Sally.
So
first of all, thank you. I just love everybody's questions. They help me so much. And I listened to the Q&A from last week yesterday, and I'm just bowled over in how everybody's sadhana helps my sadhana. I'm so grateful for that. So, and your guidance to navigate the play of the Shakti. And one of the things that was expressed, I can't remember the question, but your answer was the Shakti is teaching you, which is so mind-blowing. And so my question is, you know, I'm so captivated by Baba's autobiography. I can't even tell you how many times I've read it or looked through it or used it as a reference. And the whole, that notion of Jivan Mukti, where Baba says he knew there was nothing more for him to see.
Right.
And I'm also really captivated by the expressions of your experiences, you know, the bliss field and, you know, that's there. And sometimes you're upset, but that's still there. So if it's possible to understand that state when you're still doing sadhana, I mean, does sadhana end, or are you always doing sadhana, or is there a point when like everything just suddenly changes and then boom, you're just always in that field instead of just practicing being in that field? That's a load of questions.
Yes. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about it in class on Wednesday. But there are different views about this. You know, for instance, at least from what I'm able to gather reading different teachers, contemporary teachers, that in the American spiritual community, and I don't know if this is true in other parts of the world, the community that I'm most familiar with is the contemporary American one. But there is the general idea that enlightenment is not a fixed state, that it's always a process. And this, I believe, is essentially a Buddhist idea. In other words, because in Buddhism, you know, the Buddhists do not believe that there is such a thing as a permanent substratum of reality. So they believe that everything is constantly in changing and in process. Which is, of course, absolutely true. That the Shaivites, the Tantrikas, would say yes, and there is a state in which change is done. You know, that when Shakti merges in Shiva, there's just pure bliss and awareness. My intuition, and from what I've read in the teachings of great beings who talk about this, that the state of Jivanmukti is an attainment in the sense that you reach a certain level of consciousness that you don't slip back from. Mm. And yet that even so, it's not like that experience of, you know, total non-duality is necessarily 24/7, because you're operating in a body, you have karmas, you have samskaras. As long as you're in a body, you know, you're gonna slip in and out of transcendental states. And wouldn't you want to? You know, in other words, would you just want to sit in transcendental consciousness in this world forever? Or would you rather not play in it? So what Swami Muktananda, his autobiography is called The Play of Consciousness. And it's about his spiritual experiences, and also has a lot of his core teachings, and which are essentially the teachings of non-dual Kashmir Shaivism. But the vision of living enlightenment, Jivamukti means liberation while in the body. The vision of living enlightenment that he offered was one of full engagement in the world. So he himself was just profoundly engaged in every aspect of the world until his very last year that I knew him, as he was approaching leaving the body, he got more and more indrawn and less engaged. But up until then, there was no aspect of the world that he didn't get involved in. So, what he always said is that you can live in a state where you're aware of, you know, in the way he expressed it was of the light and awareness that underlies everything. So that's constantly in your consciousness, but at the same time, you're aware of everything else that's going on. So, and emotions come and go, you know, I would see this in him, that he would get angry, he would feel sad. He would be, you know, he would hear a joke and just sort of almost fall over laughing. So there was no diminution of, you know, of his personality. It's just that once you're permanently established in that witness consciousness bliss state, and different traditions express it differently, That is no longer it's no longer the silent unknown background. It's the front of your experience.
Mm-hmm. That's really beautiful.
So it's very beautiful. So it's a great aspiration to live your life with that degree of awareness.
And yeah. Yeah. When so when the Shakti is teaching us, the Shakti is intelligent, is that where the Shakti is ultimately taking all of us? Or is that, does where the Shakti take us, like to Jivan Mukti, come from our own aspiration for that experience?
Well, I would certainly in this lifetime, to some extent, it's going to be the result. It's going to, where it's taking you is going to be, so to speak, what you have pointed towards. Mm. But it, you know, it depends on who's talking, what the answer would be here. So in the non-dual tantra traditions, essentially, you know, because that in tantra, the understanding is that Shakti is absolutely free. So she can take you, she can take somebody who, you know, who's not even aware that they're interested in that state, and theoretically at least just, you know, just take you there. There's a piece of understanding that I've found, if we're talking about Jiva Mukti, if it's okay if I digress here. Some of you, those of you who are familiar with Ken Wilber's work and with the work of, you know, of the modern psychological understanding about levels of consciousness called spiral dynamics. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of complicated, so I'm not going to describe all the ins and outs of it. It's very interesting. But there, that theory is that as human beings, we actually evolve and mature through different structure stages so that our understanding of the world can be, is essentially based on the degree of, on the structure stage we're in. So for example, and you know, in spiral dynamics, they're all given different colors. But for instance, the stage called, which they call traditional, where you're very much concerned with the laws of society, your religion tends to be extremely boundaried by the dogmas of the tradition that you're involved in. So this is where, you know, it's very important to be a good Catholic or a good Jew. There's a stage that's somewhat more mature than that, when you're able to look at the traditional stages and realize that there are many traditions and that they all have something to teach, and that, you know, that there's a kind of freedom from being locked into that tradition. And it sort of goes on from there. So most of you here, most of us here, are what I would call post-traditional in terms of structure stages. So we're not dogmatically following a particular religious tradition. And this process of evolving with, you know, your social awareness, your human awareness, your capacity to take other people's perspective is, you know, in other words, that is what human maturity is. The more perspectives you can take, the more wide your understanding is, the, you know, the greater your spirit, your maturity as a human being. And one of the insights that these guys have had is that the traditional idea of awakened states that, you know, that the Eastern traditions especially offer us are about states rather than structures. So in other words, you can be completely awake spiritually, and yet your understanding of the world can be, you know, that of a, you know, of a Tibetan, you know, a traditional Tibetan or a traditional Hindu or a traditional Catholic, where, you know, your social understanding is parked in that structure, whereas your state can go as high as, you know, as wide as there is, but you're still going to be that person with weird prejudices and, you know, or whatever, you know, whatever structure stage you're in. And I have found that understanding to be incredibly helpful, because, you know, we all know, especially among traditional teachers, they may be very, very high spiritually, but their understanding about social structure is not necessarily as developed as we might prefer.
So that's why it can be confusing.
That's why it can be confusing. Yeah. There are traditional teachers who will tell you my way or the highway. You know, if you don't do it this way, you're never going to make it. Mm. And this is very confusing, you know. So it's just helpful, and it's one of the gifts of modernity and postmodernity that, you know, that we're able to take perspectives about the traditions, and hopefully take the best without taking the dogmas that are not helpful. You know, the dogmas that limit us. So that's, I just gave you a very small overview of a very big subject. I'm sorry if that was.
I've read a little bit about spiral dynamics, but not that much.
Yeah. So that was all in term to try to understand why the teachings about what constitutes liberation are different in different traditions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also one of the things that I've been seeing as I've been deeply studying Patanjali and comparing it with Tantra is that the so-called ancient paths, you know, of which Patanjali yoga is pretty old, Buddhism is pretty old, the Vedas are pretty old, tantric practices, both in Hinduism and in Buddhism, are much more recent, much more modern. And there tends to be a prejudice towards the old. The older, the better. Actually, I would say it's the other way around, that the more modern traditions are often represent evolutions of practitioners who have, you know, have advanced through different structure stages, and therefore they begin to adapt the practice, the spiritual practice and the spiritual teachings to their more evolved human consciousness. And that's, you know, Tantra always says we're the advanced course. We're actually more advanced than Patanjali yoga because the tantric Shaivites understand that there are realms of divinity that are beyond what Patanjali calls Purusha.
Mm.
So, to understand that just helps clear up a lot of the confusion.
Yeah, it just helps to know and contemplate that, you know, being a full person in the world, you know, a full person meditating, you know, to hold that space as a human being is, you know, to me, a really, you know, beautiful thing to aspire to.
Yeah, really.
Fully evolve as a human, so.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you
so much.
And okay. So,
are you ready for another one?
I am. And we're. So I want to try and get everybody's questions answered. So
okay.
One question per individual.
Yeah. Yeah. Rebecca, I just asked you. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Rebecca.
So my question. I've been struggling with this meditation a bit. I can visualize the area above my head, but I don't feel any special energy. And then when I'm trying to do the watcher meditation, I ask myself the question, but I just come back with, I am the watcher, and I can't take it any further. Like there's no string for me to follow. But so, I stay with it, and then afterwards I'm exhausted.
So what was it? So I you're a little, your voice is a little bit, you know, the transmission's a little bit fuzzy. So you ask yourself the question, what comes back?
I'm the watcher.
I'm the watcher.
But I'm the watcher. And so I stay with it, but then after I get very tired and I need to lie down. And so can you talk a little bit more about the watcher?
Well, okay, sure. So a watcher is just one word. It's one word for witness. Another word is knower. And another word is awareness. So what these words refer to is this wordless knowingness or cognizance or observer that is actually always present to our experience, at least in the waking state. There are many who say that it's present in the sleep state as well. It's definitely present in the dream state. So the the purpose of this inquiry is to kindle an awareness of that awareness. So it's not necessarily to get an answer in words, but actually to turn your attention backwards so that you can be aware of the that presence which is pretty much always present to your experience. And the question, this is my experience in any case, the question is there to remind you to look behind your mind, to look behind your physical experience and notice that there is always something that's present to your experience. So you have to find the words that are psychoactive for you. You know, that it might be, what is the knower? What is it that is aware that I'm here? What is it that's aware that I'm meditating? One of my teachers used to say, meditate on that which is meditating on you. You know, so the witness, the knower is that presence which is actually, you know, there for you all the time, always aware of you. And as you become more and more aware of that, then this is the quickest and most profound way to shift your perspective from the psycho-emotional to the bigger view of what your reality really is. So it doesn't matter if you're having an energetic experience when you ask this question. I gave you this practice where you turn, you know, you find the space above and behind your head, simply because for me and for many people, it's a very immediate way of positioning yourself so that it's easier to recognize that what you're turning to is something that is actually behind your mind. You know, it's your mind is the foreground, the witness awareness is the background. So what you really want to do is become aware of the background. I hope that helps. Just ask the question without worrying about it, and just notice what arises in response to the question. And if it's words that are arising, ask what is it that knows that, you know, that these words just arose, or what is it that is able to observe that these words just arose, and it will come to you. It's an experience. It's not an intellectual recognition. It's an arising.
Okay. Thank you.
I can see that you, that it's okay. It'll come.
Okay.
The thing is that we're so accustomed to asking questions and getting an answer. So the answer to this question is not an answer. The answer to this question is a shift in state. And if your intention is to become aware of your awareness or become aware of the witness, sooner or later, asking the question and noticing the wordless experience that arises is going to show you what it feels like. It's really about what it feels like.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you for asking the question, because again, I'm sure that other people have this same confusion. It is very subtle. And we often don't believe that we're actually having this experience. You know, and one of the things that great teachers often say is you're always having this experience. The witness is always present. You're just not aware of it. So this practice is there to make you aware of what already is always already there. And because it's like the water we swim in, and we so take it for granted, it's sometimes hard to see it first, or hard to believe that you're actually seeing it. So at a certain point, you know, you just have to say, okay, this is what happens when I ask this question. Let me be as aware of that and turn my awareness and my attention towards it, and it will begin to reveal itself to you.
I like that image. That's very helpful. Let's just sort of wait for it to come.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Sheila's next.
Hi, Sally. This is Sheila. How are you?
Hi, sweetie.
I'm really loving this class. I have, over the past few years, and I think I've talked to you this before, I've really struggled with the meditation after meditating, feeling like I had good meditations for a while. So I've been integrating more chanting, and that seems to kind of help me move into the meditation. One of the experiences that I've been having in particular with this is that I've been doing that kind of observing the Atman and kind of turning my attention backward. And it seems as when I'm doing that, like everything starts slowing down. Like, I mean, it's like the time just shifts, and it's disorienting for me. Like I was out walking today and I did that, and it was almost like I just couldn't even kind of figure out where I was in the, on the ground. And then from a dream perspective, I just have a lot of these very kind of expansive, like last night was like in the universe. I see these mandalas, all sorts of, and it feels like, again, they just feel disorienting. So anyway, I know it's like a good thing. So I'm not worried about that. I'm just trying to determine, like, is it being more grounded, or is it just going like, oh, well, just let it happen? And
I would say let it happen. You know, I mean, you've done many, many years of practice. You've done, you know, you've gone through lots of stages here. And my intuition is that this is a gift. You're being given the gift of entering into timeless time, you know, where the succession of moments is no longer showing up in the way that clock time shows up. Mm-hmm. So you're getting a glimpse of the fact of the eternal present. I mean, this is what the eternal present is. And, you know, time shrinks and expands according to this, to where you are. So the inner world is opening for you. And yes, it's disorienting because it's not your ordinary experience. But it is actually part of the experience of expanding consciousness, and there's I would say there's nothing you need to do about it except journal. It's really good to journal, because this is a progressive process, and there'll be many, many more layers and levels of it over time, and as you, if you have recorded it, if you have journaled about it, you're actually going to be able to see the continuity. You're going to be able to, you know, to actually realize how your consciousness is shifting. So I would say it's great what's going on. And also, you know, for all of you.
All right.
Yes, no, be happy. That's great. And don't worry about being disoriented. That's, you know, when consciousness is shifting, it is disorienting. You know, we're used to a certain, you know, frame, a certain set of limitations. You're beginning to recognize that you don't have limitations. And that's,
yeah. And so,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say the dreams are also disorienting, the sense that I don't feel rested, because they're just like very kind of like, you know, so big. Experiencing, if that makes sense. It's like I feel like kind of unrested from that.
Well, there are certain stages of practice where sleep is hard to come by, to be, you know, blindingly honest about it. You know, when Kundalini is working very strongly in your system, it often keeps you awake at night or gives you experiences that, you know, that feel exciting or agitating. And what really helps, if you can, is to spend a little more time in meditation. Because the more you're, and even if you don't feel like you're having exciting meditation experiences, just sit and watch the breath, because that's going to give you rest. that's, you know, the rest we get in meditation actually makes up for the rest that you're not getting in sleep, and you know, and also helps ground the experience. And I honestly, my intuition here is that when you have a very active Kundalini and it's wanting to show you a lot, and you're not meditating very much, then it's going to do it in dreams. So mm-hmm. you know, you might just try sitting, even if it feels boring and like you're not drawn to it. And that is what I think will allow this to kind of ground. And also one other thing, it'll pass. You know, our sadhana is so full of stages. So this is a stage. I think it's great, but your body will adjust to it. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, dear.
Barbara, if you want to unmute yourself.
Hi.
Hi, Beth.
Hi.
Hi, Beth.
I have, my meditation practice has not really included samyama. And this experience with talking about the inward and the outward buddhi and ahamkara, atman, has sort of boggled my mind in the sense that now I think I'm trying to be a little too analytical about what's happening. It's like I was meditating and an answer arose and I could actually like hear a voice in my head. So my question is, what's the voice? Because I'm getting from you that maybe answer should be more of a felt sense as opposed to an actual audible sense. If I'm hearing something, is it my ahamkara? Is it my buddhi? Who's answering? Or is it really witness that's answering?
Okay, really good question. So when the question is, where is the witness, or what is the watcher, or what is the knower, that what you should be waiting for is the felt sense of knowingness. When it's a question about an issue or, you know, something to do with your life, the answers often do come in words or come as images.
Okay.
So, and where they are coming from is through it's through the inner senses and the buddhi. So in other words, your senses pick up and reveal images and words. They're part of the structure of your inner psychic instrument, is that it comes up with words.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and they're all mediated through the buddhi. So the question is, at least this is the way I have come to understand this process, that you know, that there's a part of the mind which is moving through stimuli and analyzing the stimuli. And there's a part of your mind that is saying, this is good for me, this is bad for me, this belongs to me, this is something I got from someplace else. And then there's the part that, you know, that is actually able to not only discern what is real from what is not real, but actually come up with deep intuitive knowledge that is sometimes expressed in words.
Mm-hmm.
And this is buddhi. You know, it's buddhi also drawing on the wisdom of the self, of the you know, of the Atman. So I think it's useful, not during meditation, but perhaps after meditation, to really ask yourself, so what is this? Because you can start to notice the different aspects of your mind if you're interested in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily something that you're interested in, but it can show you a lot about the way the structure of the inner world works.
Okay.
So don't try to analyze in meditation. It's, you know, but
right.
But
I don't normally analyze. I never have.
Right.
But this whole focus has been more about work, self-work, which is samyama, and passing through the stages and reaching higher states of meditation. And I guess I never really thought to think about what state I was in. If I was in the state of awareness and witness, I just assumed that's where I was. I didn't really think that I needed to know if it was my buddhi that I was seeing. So now what I'm realizing though is that there are layers. Like you had this discussion about what you were seeing or where you were in this space, and that there was something beyond it, and then there's something beyond that. And I kind of had this vision of like a telescopic, you know, layering of passing through these stages.
Yeah.
I think I've only been to one level in my meditation. And so I think all these concepts are just sort of getting a little, maybe I'm over or analyzing or trying to be a little too intellectual about analyzing what's happening in me now.
Yeah. Yes. So I think it's useful to, you know, to make these distinctions. Mm-hmm. And that's what this text wants you to do. This text mm-hmm. wants you to say, okay, this is where, according to Patanjali, you are in your practice at this particular moment. And it's helpful to know that, because if you're serious about, you know, about liberation, it's good to know something about the stages so that you don't think you're farther than you are or less far than you are. So, you know, so this is useful information. And what I've found with this kind of scriptural material often is that it means nothing to me when I first hear it, you know, but as time goes on and my practice goes to new stages, the fact that I've read this, that I've thought about this, that I've studied this, actually helps me discern more deeply.
Mm-hmm.
It explains a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's, you know, it's not necessary to deal with it in every meditation, but hopefully it's expanding your understanding of your practice and your state, you know, such that you're able to kind of recognize how fluid our inner psychic instrument really is and how many ways there are to experience the self and to experience the truth and what it means when teachers tell you, keep going, go further, you know, go further, like the sign on Ken Kesey's bus, you know, if you remember the stories about Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, they had a sign on their bus that said further, because there was no death, there was no end to the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and when you unpack these stages as Patanjali is doing, it helps you understand, oh, okay, there's more. Not that you have to go, oh shoot, I'm not as advanced as I'd like to be, but but to recognize that there's something that can pull you towards itself.
Mm-hmm.
And curiosity about it is actually is an impetus to go further. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And thank you for asking that question. I know we can get completely lost in trying to figure it out. So we don't want to do that. But spend some time after meditation with your journal and see, okay, so what do I think this was compared to, you know, my understanding about the sutra and the commentary.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
We have Patty, who's been patiently waiting.
Okay, Patty, hi.
Hi, Sally. Thank you so much for this amazing course, as always. My question relates to the compassion meditation that was in the first course. And like others that I've seen in the listserv, I tend to have the experience that very intense emotional experiences can still kind of like target my heart, and it's hard to keep them out. And I guess my question is that like a samskara in itself to work on? And then are there any practices to kind of coax them back, that kind of invasive emotional experience out to the kind of safer global space outside of the heart?
Well, are you saying that when you see something painful or when you hear, when you're with somebody who's expressing emotional pain, that you take it on?
Exactly. Yeah.
I think most of us do that.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of ways that I have found skillful for dealing with it. One is to actually create space around yourself and the feeling.
Sure. Okay.
And so that, you know, so you let yourself feel the feeling and then you recognize that there's a kind of spaciousness around it and you can actually hold the feeling in space, and that, and the energy will kind of, you know, the intense energy will kind of morph and distill itself.
Sure.
In the space. And the other is to consciously, and this, it takes a while to be fluid with this space in front of the heart, but just, you know, when you're feeling triggered or when you're feeling intensely empathic, you know, just take some time and center yourself in the outer heart and breathe, and don't be upset that you're triggered, but know that if you can stay in that outer heart space, even for a minute or two, it's going to shift the experience. And, you know, we're learning to center ourselves in aspects of our inner being that we're not used to.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes some practice.
Sure.
And it's kind of, at some point it just kind of clicks into place and you know, oh, okay, I can move back and forth from being inside and being totally triggered by someone else's pain to being able to be aware of their pain, feel their pain, sympathize with their pain, but be sufficiently detached, because
mm-hmm.
I'm in this other heart space.
Sure.
That it's not all coming into my body.
Right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Patty.
Okay, thank you.
Susan,
hi.
Hi, Sally. Again, thank you for this class. And I really haven't been on the listserv. I'm juggling a lot of commitments, but I've been very involved. And as true with the previous classes, this is just transforming my practice, my life, my consciousness in amazing ways. And I'm hoping you'll do the fourth book. I'm putting in a vote. My question is about the subtle differences between the sattvic buddhi and the purusha. I have a long-term witness practice before I even came to yoga. Yoga kind of put it into context. And so for me, if I'm looking for the witness or the knower, there's a place where I just kind of, instead of looking for it, I am it. And I've been assuming that that's a purusha. But with this last class, talking about the sattvic buddhi, I've been investigating it further, because the buddhi to me also has the qualities of awareness or of knowing. And this is what I've come to. I just kind of want to check it in with you, that to me, if the awareness has absolutely no conceptualization or no personal aspect to it, to me, that seems more the purusha, just absolute pure awareness. But if the awareness has any conceptualization or is looking in any way objective at it, like even if I'm analyzing it, the minute I'm analyzing it, I'm in the buddhi, because then there is this subject-object split. Would that be correct, or could you refine that anymore?
That's pretty much how I experience it. One of the things that I find really helpful about the way it's discussed in book 3 of the Yoga Sutra is this understanding that the buddhi, when the buddhi is fully sattvic, it reflects purusha.
But it reflects, but it's still not. I mean, is there a point where we actually are purusha? Or
yeah, because it's sort of like buddhi dissolves. That reflection in buddhi dissolves back into purusha at a certain point.
Okay.
And I actually believe this is why the text put so much emphasis on samadhi, and you know, not all of us all the time are able to get into samadhi in a particular meditation, you know, which is one of the reasons why we recommend retreat practice, you know, just times when you make space for sitting in meditation for a long enough time to actually find yourself in a samadhi state. And in my experience, that's when the reflection of Purusha in buddhi can most easily dissolve back into Purusha. You know, you're a very experienced and advanced meditator, so you know it may be a normal experience for you. So, it's when there's no conceptualization at all, and yet you're awake. You're not in a dull, tamasic, sleepy state. You're fully in clarity. That sounds to me a lot like Purusha.
All right, thank you. And thanks again for this class.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for that question.
All right, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Sally. Just a couple of specific questions about the two points on the forehead. How do they relate, and how do they relate to the inner experience of that chakra, and the relationship between Brahmarandra and Sahasrara?
So Brahmarandra is inside the skull. So it's that spot that, you know, it's like the top of the Ajna, and it's called the door of Brahma. There's a lot. I mean, this different texts put Brahmarandra in different places, so that I'm going with this. So the Sahasrara is the space that's above the crown. Brahmarandra leads into Sahasrara. And, you know, when you're in Sahasrara, or the upper Dwadashanta, as it's called in Shaivism, the upper space of 12, that's what Dwadashanta means, you actually are, you're in the state that is ready to just merge into the highest consciousness. And in Brahmarandra, there's still a feeling of, you know, you're in the body. There's me and you and me and that. And it as Sahasrara opens, if you're able to just fully immerse yourself in it, you just eventually enter into realms that are larger than your individuality. So the other question was about these two spaces in the forehead.
Direction to go above and behind a couple of inches. Is that where that is, or is it?
I'll tell you. This is where my head. Here's the space that I'm talking about. It's a little bit above. It's a little bit behind, and you're measuring it from the fontanelle, from the top of the skull. Okay. Yeah. So and it is in the Sahasrara that Brahmarandra is the entrance point into it. The Sahasrara just goes on and on and on. Yeah. And I don't feel like I can say, you know, I don't feel like I have complete authority about the nadis up here. But what I'm seeing in myself, and what the tantric texts talk about, there are actually several nadis, several channels in the upper head. And they're very close together. They're all engaged with the Sushumna, but you know, some take you a little bit this way, some take you straight. And you know, and so the experience is a little bit different if you're in one of these nadis. And that's not to confuse you, but because in one sense, they're all of this is happening in this space above the crown. But one of the things about recognizing that you can be having absolutely authentic experiences that have a different tenor to them, a different feeling to them, you know, when you're meditating in these parts of your subtle body, it's interesting that these different sages and practitioners have given names, you know, different names to these different spaces even though they're all part of, you know, of the upper channel, the upper centers in the body. Because I think that they, you know, these people who are professional meditators, you know, professional upper chakra psychonauts, you know, have been very concerned with creating a map. You know, this is where you are. This is the Lakshmi Nadi. This is the Chittavaha Nadi. And, you know, they have different names for them. They're all really offshoots of Sushumna. And they're all leading to higher states or higher realms. I hope that helps.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So these places on the forehead, this meditation where we're focusing on the nostrils, the center between the eyebrows and the center of the forehead, it's on the outside of the body. And what this practice does is it opens up the subtle body so that you're beginning to be able to meditate and experience yourself as bigger than your body or as not necessarily confined to your body. So that's really the point of doing it on the surface, because as perhaps you've noticed, when you meditate from the nostrils to the space, you know, the corners of the eyes to the space between the eyebrows to the forehead, eventually, and it doesn't necessarily take that long, you're not even touching those spaces anymore. The whole thing has gotten bigger.
Yeah.
You're in an inner space that is actually not inside the body. It's a pretty interesting experience. And eventually your consciousness expands and the possibility of just being in inner space with the body having revealed that it's a part of everything. You know, this can happen with this meditation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the question.
All right. Jill?
Hi, Jill.
Hey. I'm loving this class, and I asked this in Listserv, and you kind of answered it, but I'm just going to ask it again. It's more of a textually based question. I'm still a little confused about the definition of the word samyama, particularly in, I'm just going to read it in the Sutra 4, the different translations, but we'll just go with the one, when these three, concentration, meditation, absorption, are brought to bear on the subject, they are called samyama. And then later on they say it's stage by stage, but then some other places it sort of seems it's simultaneous. So then particularly again, so connect to Sutra 29 by making samyama on the navel. Does that mean we're doing all three, or is it simultaneous, or what does it mean stage by stage?
Okay, so the word samyama is interpreted differently depending on your stage of meditation. So the samyama that Patanjali is talking about is a stage that arises when you're you're capable of entering samadhi at will, and or you know after a period of time, and once you become really fluid in all the stages, which are really stages of greater and greater absorption, you know, so one of the the things that Patanjali talks about a lot and in different ways in different sutras and different books is, you know, as you know, the different types of samadhi, the so-called lower samadhi, which is a pretty high state, samprajnata samadhi, where there is content. You know, you're meditating on something, you're absorbed in something. When you're in samprajnata samadhi, you can turn your focus, your concentration to a part of the body, to an idea, to a concept. And while in deep meditation, focus on that, whether it's the navel, the heart, you know, the sun, the crown. And over time, the deeper meaning of that object will be revealed. So that's what Patanjali means by samyama. Now, and other contemporary practitioners have used this word samyama to to mean intense concentration. And so it's a practice that you can do before you're immersed in samadhi, you know, as a way of really bringing your, all your faculties to bear in a meditative state. And, you know, I find it, sometimes when we're doing the contemplation practice that we do, you could get your, you can, you know, you can go into a meditative state, ask the question, and something will be revealed that is much deeper and more essential than what you can get thinking about it. That's a type of samyama. And it's not the ultimate in samyama because you're not necessarily in pure samadhi. So you don't have that faculty of prajna fully developed in that moment.
Yeah.
But it is a way of, especially for someone who's done a lot of practice and has a sense of familiarity with the inner space, you can create a kind of samyama which will give you deeper and more essential information, even though in your practice you may not be totally immersed in a samadhi state.
Okay.
That help?
Yeah, because it feels to me more like when I'm doing the one on the navel that I'm doing more of a concentration. Like, yeah. I don't feel like I'm clearly not someone who lives in a samadhi state. So I feel like I'm doing, as you said, more of an intense.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And
that's just where I am.
Yeah. So it's that is a type of samyama.
Okay.
It's the type of samyama that we can practice before we have completely cultivated a full samadhi state. And yes, you're right. It's essentially deep concentration.
Okay.
That said, the more you come to it from meditation, you know, from a meditative space, the more authentic your experience of it is going to be.
And is there a sense of like knowing that you're in that state when you're in that, or afterwards you reflect on it? As you, there's not this knowing sense while you're in it. For someone like me, like I don't have that ability to know what state I'm in when I'm doing it.
Yes, normally we reflect on it and compare it to other experiences and
yeah, okay,
and recognize that. And of course, if it is samadhi, then you don't necessarily know that you're in that state. You know, you're simply in the state you're in.
Right. So there's not some component. That's what I thought I was maybe missing, that I was watching myself in that state and knowing I was going from state to state.
But at some point, the more you experience these different levels, the more you start to recognize them. So, and this is, again, it's another one of the reasons why contemplating your meditation experience and journaling about it is so helpful, because, you know, meditation experience is so ephemeral, and we have, you know, we tend to not accept the depth of our experience and to forget that we had it. So if you're journaling and if you're really trying to understand what it is to be in dharana or in dhyana or in samadhi, and you're recording your experience, then you actually have some way to understand it and to really have confidence that you can recognize your own inner states.
So it's okay to recognize it later, not while we're—
Okay. It's okay. Sort of more or less the way it is for most of us.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
So Marilyn has a question, and then I think it will be our last.
Okay.
Marilyn?
Hi, Sally. It's so sweet to be here with you like this. Oh,
so sweet to see you guys.
Yeah. One thing, I've loved the meditations that you've given in the last two lectures, a whole bunch of them. One of them that I really loved was the crown meditation, where we had that silver moon over the head, and we feel all our guides and our helpers, and I just love that kind of thing. So I want to know, what can I do to download that more, or just hang out with the silver moon, or I love the idea of, you know, these deep beings caring about me in that way. And I'd love to enhance that if that's possible.
Well, the way you do it is doing it. You know, I mean, just go into meditation and imagine, feel the presence of the moon. I intended to make it a audio of that, and I will try and do that this week. So you know, I'll give you audio instructions in it.
It's in your crown meditation.
It's in the crown. No, I know what. Yeah, I know where it is. So I would just, you know, if doing it with guidance is helpful, then listen to the audio and follow it. But what will start to happen is that you know, this is a part of you. So the more you practice, the more familiar it becomes, and the more you get to the point where you can just kind of go there, visualize the moon, ask for the presence of the guides. Sometimes they come and sometimes they don't. You know, it's one of the great things about Sangam is when we're all focused there, it gives some power to the practice. But the more you do it, the more you practice with it, the more you begin to get awareness of who and what these guides are, and the more experience you have of them. And then what eventually happens is that, you know, you start to be aware of the fact that they're present all the time, because in fact they are, you know, and that the more conscious you make of consciously, the more conscious you become of their presence, the easier it is to just go, okay, I need some help from, you know, I need some help from the grandmothers, or I need some help from, you know, Krishna, I need some help from my guides whose names I don't know. And you'll get an immediate sense of their presence. You know, because what the sages say is that these beings are, they're hovering around you. They're part of, you know, they're there for you. And mostly because we're not aware of them, they're trying to help us, but we're too dense to get it. So what this practice actually does is kindle our awareness of their presence.
And their presence, and what about their downloads for us?
What about their downloads for us?
How do I best open to that?
What I like to do is I like to write, you know, like if you're trying to experience some wisdom, one way to do it is to summon the guides and then, you know, just do automatic writing. Just let yourself write without intervening in it with your mind. And a lot of the time that the energy or the message or the download will come through your hands. If the download that you're seeking is a state change, then you'll know, because your state will change. You know, if the download you're seeking is wisdom or information or affirmation, then, and you're not sure you can distinguish it, getting your thinking mind out of the way and just letting yourself write allows you to actually channel that wisdom. It just comes directly through your hands onto the paper. That's how I've found to do it. Somehow the hands have the capacity to, you know, to be the vehicles for this in a much more reliable way than your mind.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marilyn. Thank you all so much. And this week's is our last class. My intention is to do another teleclass starting in early April. I'm considering doing a class on devotional practice based on some of the devotional texts like the Bhakti Sutras and their others. And I'm also thinking about doing a class on the Bhagavad Gita, which we have done before, but which I just think is so significant and so germane. I'd like to do it again. So if you have any preferences, you can let me know. And any other suggestions, I'm happy to accept. But I'm feeling that since we have been focusing on, on the Patanjali yogic tradition, that it might be really great to focus on the devotional traditions and see what the wisdom that we've brought from this rather hardcore Raja Yoga approach that we've been doing, how this particular practice can transform our experience of devotional practice, which many of us think of as, you know, sort of mush brain practice, but which is actually extremely skillful way of opening up the inner world. So, and again, I'm very happy to entertain suggestions. So again, thank you so much. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for these great questions. And we'll meet on Wednesday at 5 o'clock my time and often in the future. So let's end with Om. Let's do three Oms together. Om. Thank you all so much. So much love to each of you, and have a great rest of your day, evening, and week. Namaste.